This is the Management 291 podcast, produced by thegovernanceproject.org.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, Anthony.
Tell me, are you the kind of guy who sees the glass as half full or half empty?
I'm more of a half full kind of guy.
What does that imply about you?
I think what it means is I'd rather have my glass half full than half empty. No, but more seriously, I think I tend to look at things more positively.
As opposed to
maybe always approaching a situation thinking the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try and do is see what the situation might have to offer me and how I can fit into it and hopefully make it better.
Okay. And you do that consistently?
I hope so. And I think, you know, I don't think I do it consistently, actually. I think you're calling me out on that, Anthony, and I think you're right to. I think there are definitely some settings where I probably am a very sort of half-full kind of a guy, and there are other situations where maybe I'm less comfortable, and I'm probably a little bit less optimistic now that you make me think about it.
Okay, that's interesting. Because my next question was going to be, if you are consistently half-full or consistently half-empty, or somewhere in between, does that say anything about your biases here in life?
Or it just says that I'm a boring person.
No, I think, I mean, I'm a half full kind of person as well. And I see it as, largely in certain situations, I'm very optimistic. But in others, I wouldn't call myself a half empty person, but I do view things with a slightly different aspect of realism, a different take, more prudent.
Yeah, and I think it's normal when we're sort of confronted with a situation where we're not as stable, we don't understand our surroundings as well, or maybe we're meeting new people for the first time. I think it's a normal reaction to be a little more conservative. And yeah, you might still be optimistic, but you might be a little bit less outgoing than you usually are.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually quite consistent with the use of bias. I mean, bias is a form of shortcut in decision making. So if you are in a situation which is familiar to you, you will probably be faster to just give in to your natural optimism or your natural biases, optimism bias in this case, than in a situation where you're feeling unfamiliar and the bias no longer is reliable to you.
And I think the word bias itself actually has a really bad connotation associated with it. I think the fact is we all have biases going in every, you know, different direction. We just have to acknowledge that they're there. But having a bias isn't in and of itself negative. It's, as you say, it's something that helps us make decisions more quickly, more efficiently.
Correct. But on the other hand, it can actually lead you towards making certain presumptions about conditions around you, which take you down an avenue of actually taking the wrong decision because you're not thinking about it as much.
Correct. So how do you keep your bias in check?
I guess it's about being aware that you have them.
That would be a good first step.
Which is exactly going to be a very good conclusion for this part of the course. But it is interesting when you think about the fact that the rest of the world, so often they get things so wrong when we know for sure that we are so right. Is that a form of bias?
It's definitely a form of bias. I guess, why is it that we're so comfortable in knowing that we are right? And why is it so apparent to us that they are wrong? Clearly, if we ask people on the other side of that debate, they probably also think they're quite right and that we are the ones who are having difficulty understanding the situation. So how do we get to that?
Yeah, we've been discussing this before the podcast, didn't we? That we want to try and avoid talking about politics, but just politics just seems to give so many examples of, well, examples to talk about. And in particular, in this kind of topic, because if we look at the UK, there's Brexit, and we have the Brexiteers versus what the Brexiteers call the Remainers. There is very little meeting of the minds. When you see consistently any research that's done between, for example, Democrats and Republicans in the States, you find that people stick to their given positions, and there's only a very small minority, maybe about 20-25% of people who actually are swing voters, people who change their minds depending on what they've heard last. So we do see this in society And at the moment, we see a great division in society about everything from climate change. There are people who are panicking over climate change, and there are people who are just still in denial about it. We have people who say Brexit is Brexit, and it doesn't matter what it comes out as long as we've left the EU, that's the right decision. And you've got people who are saying you've got to be out of your mind. It seems like we are being driven by bias so much that we're actually dividing society because we have no common understanding of the reality around us.
And I think that's the link to organizational behavior, because all of the people that you just described on both sides of those very dramatic debates, you know, whether it's climate change, the death penalty, Brexit, on both sides of those debates, you've got very strong points of view, and as you pointed out, not a lot of mutual understanding. And I think the link with organizational behavior is those people who hold those types of views and those types of biases, well, on Monday morning, they come to work and they become your human and social capital. And our organizations consist of individuals who have biases, who have political views. And so it would be strange if all of those people came into work on Monday morning and had no biases, prejudices, or strong views about anything that they did all day long in their workplace.
So it's quite strange, really, that we're able to work together at all in some senses.
In some senses, yes. I think you're also right that there is a very small percentage of that working population that is readily able to be convinced of a different view or adopt a different position after hearing some information or some facts. So I think that's the link with the organizational behavior. Ultimately, you know, the workplace is made up of individual employees. The political scene sort of illustrates for us in a very extreme way what bias can look like and actually how ugly it can be.
Mm-hmm. And I think just to draw that parallel between society and business again, we see in society that effectively people take a stance which is related to the values or the opinions that are voiced by a certain community that they feel affiliation with. People feel, this is the group that I belong with, and therefore I'm going to support their cause or their views. In the same way, when you come into a company and you're trying to create an environment in which people will collaborate well together, what in fact we're trying to do is to create a community, a social capital within the company or the organization, which actually asks people to look up to the group objectives and ask them to sign on to supporting the initiative as a whole, which is something which, you know, is becoming more and more talked about in business, because we've been through a long period where, to be honest, I think employees have been viewed as almost a commodity, and now they're beginning to see that there is actually added value in terms of having people being loyal employees, being real stakeholders, and actually wanting to go the extra mile for the success of the company. So creating an environment where people are prone towards thinking alike, having similar prejudices, similar views, similar biases, is actually something which, in the right context and in the right organization, can be a good thing. I listened to a podcast called Hidden Brain this week, and it was talking about empathy. And I just want to try an idea out on you. We assume empathy to be a good thing, don't we?
Usually, yes, it's encouraged.
Because?
Well, because empathy is, we're taught from when we're very young that you should be empathetic towards others, and because you would want to be treated in the same way.
And if I told you that they convinced me that empathy can be a bad thing on this podcast?
I'm starting to ask some serious questions.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because, it comes back to who do we identify as being our community? Empathy is viewed as something very positive. If we view empathy towards other people, in other words, put ourselves in their shoes to feel the emotion they might be feeling when they're on the other side of the table, and we're actually reaching out to try and understand other groups of people. But if you were to suddenly decide that you'd been insulted by some other community and you were outraged, and I feel empathy towards you, it would actually make me more aggressive towards that third party as well. So it can actually reinforce tribalism. It can reinforce aggressiveness towards third parties. And I just thought it's interesting that empathy actually is a two-edged sword. It can work both ways.
I see your point, and you're right. No matter what group we are in, it's always very important for us to belong to a group, whether it's at work, at home, in our communities, at our university. Being part of a group and having shared values is something that we are taught from a very young age to value.
Mm-hmm. But what we need to do is to make sure that we have all of these kind of instincts, be it empathy or other kinds of prejudice and bias, to be aware of them and understand how they can negatively impact other people, but also how they can impact our own realities without us actually knowing it.
Because fundamentally, we believe that our values are correct, we believe that we are intelligent people, and we believe that we're perceiving everything around us. Sadly, we're not all perfect. And where there are gaps in knowledge or where we're not able to perceive certain things, these can be real traps which set us up for failure.
Well, I guess that's where the expression, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing, comes from. Because, in fact, studies after studies show that people who don't know very much about something are far more adamant that they understand and know the single truth than people who are, let's say, long-term students of a subject or have done research for many, many years. Those people who know more tend to be more prudent in their statements than people who just know a little bit.
So actually, before even getting to empathy, we should probably be talking about being open to acquiring knowledge, learning new things, meeting new people. All of these things are very important to helping us understand what our biases are and understand how far-reaching our biases can be. I think what this conversation shows is all of this means that every decision we take is, of course, impacted by our bias. And depending on the decision maker, that person may be biased to a lesser or a greater extent. Certainly, they will be biased in some way. I think it would be unrealistic to say there are people out there who can take decisions without any bias. I think that's impossible.
Right. In the past, we've argued about the fact that we need to have proper governance systems in place to make sure that we have a disciplined approach to discussing decisions. Because what triggers bias, it can be very superficial things. It can be the way you dress. It can be the way you talk. It can even be, without me even having seen what you look like or heard what you sound like, the fact that I know that you're coming from Canada immediately puts a picture in my mind, which frames what I expect to see and hear from you, and maybe then starts influencing the way I'll hear what you're saying when you eventually start speaking too.
And there's been a rise of the word profiling ever since 9/11, and a big debate on whether profiling is right or wrong, whether or not it should be used. And certainly in North America, there's been a lot of discussion about profiling not being used, as it leads to undesirable results. It leads to episodes of racism. It leads to discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that we as human beings do in a split second. We meet someone for the first time or hear them, and before we've even begun the interaction with them, our minds have already taken us through a complete profiling process. So this ability that we've developed to profile or to use bias to make our decision-making processes more efficient, more quick, yes, there is an efficiency to it, but when you start to scratch the surface, it actually has the potential to cause a lot of harm in your decision-making process. But that unfortunately seems to be the way we are built, and so that's why it's so critical in the context of this course that we have this discussion about bias and the fact that it exists, and that I think we need to develop some strategies to deal with it.
I mean, we both, I'm sure, have experiences in business or in any situation in life where something goes wrong, and your first reflection is to think about if the cause of something having gone wrong could be directly linked to an individual's characteristics or traits. You know, oh yes, so-and-so is always unreliable, or so-and-so stereotypically maybe is more of the sort of what needs to be done tomorrow doesn't have to be done today kind of mentality. And we say, oh yeah, if only they'd been more diligent in their work. When in fact, if you look at the circumstances, there's quite clearly something that's a factor from outside the control of the individual that's actually caused the situation to go wrong. Equally, how often isn't it that we, when things go right, that we are very proud and very quick to take the credit that the success is down to us, even if it's perhaps other market factors or other people's contribution even that has facilitated the successful outcome of something that we were in charge of.
And I think, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about prejudice and bias sort of in the last half century, and these topics have evolved quite a bit over time. What's can be shocking to see in the corporate world from time to time is the level of sophistication with which we mask our bias from the outside world. So to your example about an employee being lazy or maybe not being a team player, most people inside organizations have now realized that those aren't statements that you can say out loud, because that's more and more something that we don't tolerate. But of course, that doesn't prevent the thought from occurring in the first place. So we need to get really quite sophisticated in self-identifying when that happens, or identifying when other people may be thinking that.
But we do have a severe problem. I mean, one of the most well-known biases, I think, today is what we call confirmation bias. The bias whereby you see all the facts, all the things that are happening, all the things you observe around you as a confirmation only of the opinion that you've held. You don't see it as evidence of possible other alternative interpretations. We have an ability to distort our own reality, which is astonishing.
And that's where potentially inside organizations we really lose value, because we've got other very important facts almost staring us straight in the face that we're practically ignoring, or we're not asking the additional questions or doing the further investigation that might prove really beneficial for us.
If we're continuously living in a world, Michael, where we interpret everything that happens in our own favor, interpret everything that goes wrong as being attributable to somebody else, if we tend to confirm our opinions, our favorable opinion about somebody else, by only seeing their positives and not their negatives and thereby promoting them, how can we try and get control of that kind of thing? Because what we're talking about is that we've got to stop reacting on our bias. And we've got to start thinking more constructively or more analytically about how we take our decisions and how we move forward. How can we compensate for our human fallibility here?
Well, I think, and we've touched on it already, I think the first step is obviously to admit and identify that the bias exists and get agreement from everyone that there is bias and that it has the potential to impact our decision-making process. I think once you've done that, then you need to actually build it into the decision-making process and put in place mechanisms and triggers that attempt to challenge our bias from time to time.
So we're fundamentally not comfortable with challenge, are we, Michael?
No, nobody likes challenge.
Because we don't like confrontation. We don't like someone to possibly prove us wrong. We don't actually like to defend our own position very much because it makes us think too hard, maybe.
Yeah, and it feels uncomfortable. So what you do is you institutionalize it. And what do I mean by that? You make it okay. And that's a really easy thing to say and a really difficult thing to do. So how do you create the kind of workplace where people feel that they can openly challenge others' decisions? How do you create a workplace where people feel okay being on the receiving end of that kind of challenge?
Well, you can turn it around because it's actually common sense. Which is the scenario in which you are together with people where you feel quite happy to openly challenge in front of others what they're saying? What's that situation? I'm sure it happens in your private life.
Yeah, no, that's everyone's living room.
That's everyone's living room. It's around the dinner table with the family every night.
That's right.
So what's special about that environment is that everybody essentially trusts each other. They know that they're open to have discussion, maybe even think it's fun to have a bit of a debate about an issue, but where they know that no one's going to take you up on it in a bad way.
That's right.
So what we're talking about in a corporate or an organizational environment is that you have to create an environment where it's okay to to speak up, where it's okay to challenge, because everyone trusts that whatever you say, the presumption is that you're acting in good faith to try and reach a better outcome for the organization.
And I think what's really important is not just saying inside of the corporation, you know, this is a place where we encourage open debate and trust, but you actually have to follow through that with that, and you need to support employees who are involved in that debate. It really needs to be followed through with actions and sort of demonstrable evidence. Otherwise, employees won't feel like this is actually a place where it's safe to speak up. Just saying it's safe to speak up won't get you there.
Right, and it means that it has to be normal to have a situation where you can admit that you fail in something too. Amazon is a company that has its European headquarters here in Luxembourg. And I was at an alumni event not that long ago where they were describing how they try and create a learning culture within their organization. And it was very interesting. I'm not saying if it's successful or not. There are people who love Amazon. There are people who don't love Amazon. But I do find it very interesting that what they were saying was that we expect people to fail one third of the time. And we actually want people to document those failures so that others can learn from those failures. And we all learn from failures together. And that in fact, what is looked down on is if people aren't recording their failures. And of course, then it depends very much. Are the managers now acting in good faith in support of those learning opportunities, as they call them, because they ask people not only to record their failures, but actually to write down what they learned from it and how they would do things differently next time, so that can go in a database and everyone can see it and learn from it. It depends very much on how the managers react to that. Do they actually reward people for reporting their failures and showing how they've learned from their failure? Or do they somehow secretly harbor an intention and a note, oh, the next performance review, I'm going to bring this up?
Yeah, no, I feel like we're both a little bit glasses half empty on this one. It's a great example, Amazon, but, you know, I wonder, does it ever happen that maybe staff and managers forget to report the really bad failures, but then they come up with a few other failures to report that quarter, so that they can, you know, maintain their reporting obligations? It's hard to say, but it's a start. It's a start. There are many corporate cultures which, you know, it would be absolutely unacceptable to even speak of a failure, let alone do a deep dive report and share it with the rest of your colleagues.
Yeah. Over the long term, again, I think it depends very much on individuals who are in charge, how well they've been instructed and trained to receive failure reports with an open mind. The most important aspect, if you're going to try and create a learning environment based upon trust, is that you really need to lead by example from the very top. That's absolutely the essential thing. And listen, not just instruct. It has to be a two-way dialogue up and down across the organization, and people have to be excited about moving forward.
And this isn't something that's going to just happen naturally, because, you know, again, from the first part of our discussion, this is so unnatural for us as human beings to do. It's so unnatural for us to challenge our biases, to admit we've made a mistake. It's so unnatural to automatically see things from the other point of view. And so once we've built a culture of trust where we can start to experiment with that, how do we really encourage that so that it grows inside of the company? And I would argue it's not sort of going to happen through osmosis. You've really got to put in place some mechanisms inside your company to make sure this happens. So you mentioned training, but you probably want to think about, how do you reward this behavior? How do you potentially sanction behavior which doesn't really go in the way we're discussing right now? And how do you ultimately demonstrate to your employee population that this is really part of the culture and the values at this company?
Yeah. And I think it comes back to what we talked a little bit about earlier today. That is that if you're going to really feel that you are able to express yourself freely, to challenge freely, not be put out or insulted or feel endangered if someone challenges you, then you really have to make everyone understand and feel that you're focused on the same end objective. You have to create a sense of community around the organization's purpose and vision of success. I think if everyone feels like they're on the same team, it's like being on a sailing yacht in a sailing race. Everyone has to know what the objective is, and everyone has to pull in the same direction. Otherwise, you're not going to get the best possible performance out of the boat. The same thing with organization. You won't get people trusting each other implicitly unless everyone is totally unified on the direction in which you're heading. So when we're talking about biases, we've discussed the fact that we need to understand what biases and prejudices we are subject to. We have to try and challenge ourselves first and foremost and have an open mind and try really to put ourselves with empathy in the situation that those people who have different opinion from ourselves, where they're coming from. What is it that makes them believe that they are as correct as we believe we are when we're in disagreement?
That's right. And then once you've done that, if you're feeling really brave, is allow yourself to be challenged by others in a trusting and safe environment. But get that feedback and challenge your own views based on that feedback. And that's really how we get to the next level in terms of breaking down your own biases and also understanding what others might have in terms of their own bias. Mm-hmm.
So we hope that we'll have an interesting discussion in class around this subject. Obviously a lot more structure in terms of theories and stuff, but essentially it's about human relationships, how we see each other, how we relate to each other, and how we resolve conflicts that we will inevitably will encounter. One student of mine, I remember when I asked for a definition in class about defined conflict, and he referred to his grandfather who said, two people in the same state is a conflict.
There will be conflict.
Indeed.
All right.
See you next week.
That was the Management 291 podcast with Michael Schweimer and Anthony Smith-Meyer. Music by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. Thank you for listening.